This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. A few months ago, I was asked to be part of a panel discussion about politics in front of a group of high schoolers, and I sat next to Hamden Mayor Scott Jackson. He said something during the panel that you don't often hear out of municipal leaders in Connecticut, that maybe one of our problems is we just have too many towns, or at least not enough cooperation between the ones we do have. I started thinking he might just be the perfect person to engage in a long-form conversation about this issue that comes up time and time again in our show, regionalization. For one thing, his town is many, many things. It's urban, suburban, and rural all at once. It's right next to a city, New Haven, and increasingly defined by a university, Quinnipiac. He's got a unique view of the town gown and urban-suburban divide. He's also heading up the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, charged to look at a variety of issues raised by the Newtown shootings. Today, Where We Live, a chance to talk to Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden. You can join us, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. On our website, WNPR.org, you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here. I'm a big fan of the show.
Well, first of all, let's do this because I want to understand a little bit better about your town. And we've actually used Hamden in the past as a kind of a benchmark for a lot of the things about Connecticut. It does have all of these things at once. It's urban, it's suburban, it's rural. But you grew up there, so you know much better than I do. Tell me what the Hamden was like that you were growing up in and maybe how it's changed.
Well, the Hamden that I grew up in the 70s and 80s is shockingly similar to the Hamden of today. What I've noticed, so I'm 42 now, 25 years out of Hamden High School, and a lot of the people in my yearbook have come back to raise their families. That's the type of sort of idyllic childhood that we had and that we strive to offer our children now. We understand that times are different. But we still try every day to make sure that Hamden continues to be the best place to raise a family, that we can make it.
When you say things have largely stayed the same, I'm sure some things are different. Tell me about the big differences, the things that maybe now that you have this experience, you've come back, you're running this city. What are the things that you see that are quite a bit different from they were growing up?
Well, it's bigger.
Yeah.
It's bigger. And in fact, we have, I think, a lot more problems, particularly in the southern end of town, in terms of things like drugs and street crime and things like that we didn't see. Not to say they weren't there, but they weren't quite as apparent. So not only through the law enforcement side, but through the social service side, we're trying to correct that to the best of our abilities.
When you say it's bigger, there's more people there, but it's also, as towns go in Connecticut, fairly large, and that's one of the reasons why you get a chance to have everything from farms and a state park to very suburban areas to very, very urban areas. Do you think that the town of Hamden, as it is constituted right now, from a geographic standpoint, does it make sense? I mean, does it make sense to have a town that's all of these things stretching from the border of New Haven all the way up to sort of the countryside?
Right, I think it does. Now, so Hamden is 33 square miles and we have about 240 miles of road, which makes us geographically almost twice as large as New Haven with as much physical assets. So I think it does make sense, but I think that people also have to understand that deploying resources over such a large area can prove challenging. It can take 25 minutes to drive from southern Hamden to northern Hamden if you're going from a park in southern Hamden, Rochford Field, to a park in Hamden, Brooksville Park. It can take you 25 minutes. So in things like the delivery of police resources and fire resources, we have to be very specific with how we do that. When it comes to things like paving roads, we have to understand that we have a lot less apparatus than our sister city to the south, but we still have to clear the roads as effectively.
When it comes to some of the issues that you talk about in the southern part of your town, the crime, the drugs, the things that maybe have long been there but continue to crop up, I'm wondering, as you have conversations around town, how those issues are thought about by people elsewhere in the community. I mean, when you talk to people in the suburban or the rural parts of Hamden, what do they say about problems with crime or other issues to the south part of the town?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people think that it's confined to southern Hamden, when it's clearly not. we put out press releases almost every day warning our residents of crime. And some of my colleagues say, Scott, I'm not sure why you would do that. It kind of makes your town seem unsafe, don't you think? And I respond, and I got 23,000 housing units, over 240 miles of road with 108 police officers. They're not going to be everywhere all the time. So our people have to know what to look out for so they can look out for themselves.
We're talking with Scott Jackson. He's the mayor of Hamden. We're going to be talking a bit about regionalization in Connecticut, and I'd like some of your ideas as well. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always join the conversation at WNPR.org or on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I mentioned at the top that we sat next together in a panel discussion. It was at Quinnipiac University. We're talking to young people about politics, and they kind of pressed us to fix things, to try to figure out what goes wrong in politics, what goes right. And you said some things that maybe aren't that surprising, because I know you've been working on regionalization efforts for a while, but you even went so far as to say, you know, this isn't always popular coming from a town leader to say, you know, maybe we've got too many towns, or maybe the town structure that we have doesn't make a whole lot of sense. To talk that through with me a little bit. I mean, what do you think makes sense and doesn't make sense about a state that has 169 little municipalities all fighting for the same dollar?
Well, I think it comes from my background, which is kind of unusual, I think, for a chief elected official, which is actually having worked in day government for my entire professional career. And we hear things. We hear that people want high-level services, high quality. They want to be happy where they're living and where they're shopping and where they're working. But the tax structure in Connecticut is pretty poor. And the impacts that it has on the delivery of services at the local level are apparent. And so while we want the essence of our communities to remain the same, but we also don't necessarily look outside for other opportunities to create that with our neighbors. Because you know what? I don't think there's anybody in the state of Connecticut who's going to say, you know, I'm for worse schools, or I don't want my roads paved, or I don't want my sidewalks done. They're not going to say that. Everybody wants the same thing. So when we take some of these core things that are common amongst all of us and start to look for solutions that could have positive tax ramifications, I think it's something that we ought to do. I'll give you an example. We have a school district, a fairly large school district, and that school district employs a curriculum director. When I go around the state of Connecticut, kids all look the same to me. Why do 160 school districts, you know, hire a school curriculum coordinator? These are things that I think we need to look at, because that's money out the door at a time where people are asking us, you know, times are hard, and taxes keep going up. What can you do? These are some of the things I think that we have to be very focused on looking at some of these opportunities.
As you say, as you go around the state, kids all look the same. But as you also said, you know, your town is maybe unique. It's larger than most physically, and it does have just the wide range of human experience. I mean, there are many school districts in which almost all the kids are economically disadvantaged. And there are other school districts in which almost all the kids are economically advantaged. In the second school district I just mentioned, most of them expect to go to school, and probably a very good school, after K through 12. They're going to go to college. In some of the urban districts, many kids don't even see a pathway outside of their neighborhood. Your community has sort of all this wide range. Maybe I'm not just picking on the curriculum director, but maybe there is something unique about Hamden that needs to have a unique educational solution. Am I wrong there?
Well, not necessarily. So Hamden High graduated last Monday. When school is in session, at any given moment, there are 2,000 students and maybe 2,500 people.
And it's one high school for a fairly big town,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes, okay, so, which makes it one of the largest high schools in the state of Connecticut. So Hamden High is bigger than some towns in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
So does it require a certain type of personality? Absolutely. Now, we still make Rhodes Scholars. We send kids to the Ivies and and MIT all the time. But you know what? Some of those kids walking across the stage with the Rhodes Scholars and the folks who are bound for MIT are going to a community college and needing remedial education. So our challenge is do, I think, run the gamut in terms of trying to keep really high performers engaged and active and focused, as well as reaching back and taking some of these folks who may be a little bit less engaged for a variety of reasons, and making sure that they have the same set of opportunities. Because right now, and it is indicative of the state of Connecticut, I think, that is not the case. And interestingly enough, this is not, you know, as it relates to education, this is not a partisan issue. Spent some time with about 20 of my chief elected officials over a two-day period a couple of weeks ago. And from the Republican side, specifically Mark Boughton, and from the Democratic side, Bill French from Bridgeport, were on the exact same page that this two Connecticuts that seems to be emerging is a problem for all of Connecticut.
As we talk with Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden, we'll take your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Let's go to David, who's calling from Madison. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Well, I really like this topic. It's a sensible approach that needs to be considered. And I come from one of the higher end towns, Madison. And you know, it's great to have the rivalries in sports, but if our police officers work together, then it might actually give our police in Madison something to do, because we've got an extraordinary number of them, and they sit around, you know, running speed checks and arresting, you know, people that are not doing much. But it's a ridiculous waste of money. When you sample out the amount of crime we have versus the number of police officers, and then you add on top of that the facilities we have. I mean, we actually have an armored car in Madison, Connecticut. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So these resources need to be spread out where they're needed, and that would actually force the police to work together with other communities, which I think is probably a better strategic approach.
David, before I put your question, and I thank you very much for this, to Scott Jackson about police services, I'm wondering, do you feel that in your town where maybe you could share resources when it comes to law enforcement, is education a different matter in Madison, if you take my drift?
You know, that's a great question, and I thought about that myself, and I think it'd be much easier to share police resources because, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of selfishness, and that's part of human nature, and maybe we have more of it in Madison. I really don't see the community moving forward in that direction, although it's a great idea. I'm all for that, but I just think the feasibility is probably close to zero, and I'd love to hear your guests' comment on that as well.
I would, too. David, thanks so much for your phone call.
Well, I'll start with the schools and then go back to law enforcement. I agree that it would be an incredible uphill climb to, say, consolidate districts. Because when people are investing in their homes, you know, particularly as a young family, the first thing you're looking at is, tell me where my children are going to go to school and convince me that they're going to get a quality education that is going to provide them opportunities for the rest of their lives. So I get that. I understand that. And it's going to be a long way, I think, before we're ready to look at that. But some of the services provided by the schools, or some of the back end operations that really don't have a classroom impact, I think, are the places where we need to look. I think that schools and boards of education should be concerned with what's happening in the classroom. Now they also have to buy paper. They don't need a whole purchasing staff to buy paper when the town has a purchasing staff. They don't need a whole finance department to cut checks when the town has a finance department. So there are some of these things that are just in the background, sort of central service operations.
But I'll just stop you and say, and this happens in a lot of different towns. As soon as any part of the schools is controlled by the town, because there is this split in most communities, right, where the schools run their own shop and the town runs its own shop, if you start taking a little piece of that work, there may be thought among some, certainly in the school board, that the town is trying to wrest control away through its purchasing power.
It is, but there are also enough examples in the state of Connecticut where they work cooperatively, where that's not the case. I mean, people don't get into education to be bureaucrats. They get into education to teach kids and inspire people. And so I want to let them do that. But we also have to be mindful of the bottom line. And there are opportunities that need to be mined. Now, in my town, tomorrow we will have a new superintendent. And we haven't discussed this yet. But we certainly will, because I think what we need to do for our taxpayers to show that we're doing the right thing, when our Board of Education has a budget of $83 million, is say, what are you doing to control costs? Where are the duplicated efforts? Because we owe it to our residents to at least have that conversation. Then I'll go back to the law enforcement, if I may. It gets really tricky on the law enforcement side, but there are some real opportunities. In the Hartford area, the Capital Region has what's known as the Blue Plan, which is a tiered emergency response to a situation like the shooting at Hartford Distributors, where the assets are regionally held and deployed as required through a central dispatch. I think those are some real opportunities, not only for cost efficiency, but also for a scaled response to something like the tragedy at Sandy Hook.
What are the, before we take our break and we talk a little bit later in the program about the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, which you are a very big part of, what are some of the barriers to what David from Madison is talking about, to shared resources on the law enforcement side between communities?
Well, you have to pick your partners and do it strategically. So there are neighborhoods in Hamden that are indistinguishable from the other side of the invisible line in New Haven. And so police officers on both sides of the line need to be able to know who the good actors are and who the bad actors are. So creating those partnerships works. We have for a long time had such a relationship with the city of New Haven through a memorandum of understanding where we can cross each other's borders for certain purposes. But the barriers are could be jurisdictional. There need to be some tweaks to state law to really make it effective.
When we come back from a break, we'll continue our conversation with Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden, talk about regionalization. We'll take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Up until not so long ago, the line between New Haven and Hamden wasn't always so invisible. We'll talk about a fence that's come down. We'll also talk about town-gown relationships with the big university in Hamden, Quinnipiac University. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That sound from earlier this year of a fence, an actual fence that separated the towns of Hamden and New Haven, coming down. We reported on that story with Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent earlier this year. Today on the program, we're talking with Scott Jackson. He's the mayor of Hamden. He's got big ideas about regionalization. We're talking with him this hour about that. Talking about the urban-suburban divide, about the differences between our communities and some of the similarities as well. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We'll get to your phone calls in just a moment. That fence, the actual physical fence, put up some like 65 years ago or something like that. It finally came down. I'm just going to go back to you growing up there. You always knew about this fence, but what was the fence to you?
I'll be honest. So I grew up, as a crow flies, maybe a mile.
A mile from the fence, yeah.
I thought it was an army barracks on the other side of the fence. I did. Now, my cousin's girlfriend lived in the development there, Brookside and Rockview, and I went out there a couple of times, and it took, I don't know, 25 minutes. I had no idea it was on the other side until, frankly, probably about 12 or 13 years ago. And I said, wait a second, that's right there? Yeah, the fence was put up by mutual accord, two generations ago, and that was a bad place. That was a terrible, terrible implementation of social policy. It was dense. It was one road in, one road out. Easy to get lost. It was a terrible layout and a terrible place to live, and terrible things happen there every single day. Hmm. So the neighbors sort of adjacent and nearby the fence, many of whom actually grew up in the development, the fence symbolized safety and security and a good place to raise a family. So it was invested with these with these characteristics. And the neighbors are frankly going through a grieving process now that it's gone. So, you know, the way I look at it is, you know, the 12th step of grief is to do something. And what I think needs to be part of the neighborhood dialogue right now is, well, what are those other elements that create a sense of safety, security, and a good place to raise a family? And let's focus on those because the fence is gone.
Do you think it's a good idea that the fence is gone?
I think it's a good idea. I think that just the way it laid out, and again, this is, you know, these things about these ways that we've cut our communities up and separated them, is that there really wasn't any process on the Hampton side, and I think that's what the neighbors really wanted. But under Connecticut general statutes, the processes were followed. They just weren't really, Hampton really wasn't engaged in them.
Yeah. So I guess, and as we talk about this, we've talked about this in the program, I think one of the things that's fascinating to the rest of the state, because there are probably a few other instances like this in the state where there are actual physical barriers. You can see the change between one town and another. And this just symbolized an awful lot. Some of it clearly is realistic and some of it not. So you mentioned these next things the community needs to do on your side of the border and on the New Haven side of the border. What are those things? I mean, what's the next step? Once a fence that symbolizes both physically and emotionally this barrier between two communities, once it comes down, what has to happen next? What do you think?
Well, this is something that Mayor DeStefano tried about 2 years ago. There was sort of heated debate about it, and Mayor DeStefano said that or offered to sort of convene a neighborhood group with folks from both sides. That met for about a year and a half, but there wasn't a whole lot of progress with that. But neighbors are neighbors, no matter where you are. And so I like to tell a story about my life growing up, where my father gave me the shovel when I was 11 years old. And he said, "Scott, I'm not shoveling anymore. It's your job now." And I went unshoveled. And my father was an old Navy man, and so he was big on inspections. He went out to inspect, and he said, "Son, that's not how you shovel. You shovel the Gilmans on the other side and the Nevilles on the other side. Because one day you're not going to be here, and they're going to shovel for you." And today, the Gilmans are still on one side, and the Nevilles are still on the other, and they shovel my mother out. She's still in the same house. Mm. So that, to me, is the way neighborhoods work. We need to work to create such a dynamic here. People are going to be across the street, and we actually have this in a couple places in Hampton, where the north side of the street is Hampton and the south side of the street is New Haven. The kids all play together, but they go to separate schools and they're different communities. But they're more integrated, and that's what we're going to have here. We're going to have homes on one side of Wooden Street that are in New Haven and homes on the other side of Wooden Street that are in Hampton, but they're going to be neighbors. And we have to sponsor some efforts to make sure that they're all safe and they're all secure. My fire chief met with New Haven's outgoing assistant chief 2 weeks ago to go over fire coverage. As it turns out, a Hampton fire station is closer than a New Haven fire station to those New Haven homes. We're probably going to be primary on structure fires should they occur there, just like New Haven is primary in some other locations in Hampton. At some point, we just have to have these conversations with each other. We're going to or New Haven is going to build a substation, and they're going to build it big enough for us to join them there. So these are some of the efforts that we have to undertake to try to synthesize the neighborhood that has certainly been separated. But we've actually been able to do it fairly well with many of our neighboring communities. We've got five neighboring communities, and we have such relationships with all of them.
It almost seems interesting, though, just to be able to, I mean, in the way you describe it, to create a neighborhood out of scratch. I mean, people living right next to each other, they couldn't be neighbors in the traditional sense that you had growing up or that I had growing up, and that by doing this, you actually create a holistic neighborhood, the one that the firemen and firewomen on one side of the line actually take care of the people on the other side of the line. That seems like neighborhood creation in a way that we don't get to see too often.
Well, because there's something less organic about the way that this one is hashing out, because it really is just making something right next to something that exists. Usually when you have developments, they're kind of, you know, it's an old farm that's now developed, and so they're all new neighbors together. But this is certainly a little bit different.
Let's go to the phones. Josh is calling from Hartford. Hi, Josh. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to address something that both the guest and the caller from Madison said about how the objections to regionalization come from folks who, I mean, the caller from Madison said they're selfish, but they say, well, look, we chose this home. We've spent this much money, so we're funding these schools with our property taxes. And whether that's selfish or not, I think I wanted to point out that it sort of misses something, which is that all the folks in those smaller towns around big cities benefit from the hospitals, especially, and other tax-free things that cities have. So Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven, Waterbury take huge hits and are missing huge amounts of money in property taxes so that those surrounding towns can have that service. So I think it's worth considering when people think, well, this is our money, and so these should be our schools for our kids, that they would not like it so much if they all had to build their own hospital and take that tax hit.
Josh, thank you very much for the phone call. Scott Jackson, what's your reaction?
Well, it's an excellent point, and it goes back to something that I think we know is a problem, even if the fix eludes us a little bit, which is the property tax system in Connecticut is abjectly broken. Certain places bear the brunt, and certain places reap enormous benefits. So when we look at that property tax structure as sort of the underlying reason for some of these, real remarkable differences between communities that are, pretty close to each other, it's something that has to be addressed. So my friend Brendan Sharkey, the Speaker of the House, who represents Hamden, he's been trying to work on this for a long time. He came out of city government. He was chief of staff to one of our mayors back in the 90s. So he understands this. Now, obviously, it's a total property tax reform is going to be a long work in process or progress. However, some things like state funding of special ed programs in schools, which for my community costs us a few million dollars a year. Moving that over to direct state funding is a way that we can start to equalize some of these issues and start to work down that road where we can say it's good for economic development, it's good for community relations, it's good tax policy not to be so reliant on the local property tax.
One of the things he sat in that very chair and talked to me about is this idea of payment in lieu of taxes is called pilots. And this is where towns have to essentially go, towns and cities have to go to the state and say, hey, look, we got all these services, nonprofits in our communities. They're not paying taxes. We got to get something back. The state, even at its best, only gives you back pennies on a dollar. So if you, as Josh suggested, you have a big hospital, you have a big university in your community, you're just not getting the tax revenue. I'll talk to you in a moment about what this means to you with a big university in your town. But Brendan Sharkey's latest plan is what he calls a reverse pilot. This is something different. He says, big nonprofits, you got to pay your taxes, and then you've got to go back to the state, and you've got to ask for the money. So that means that the dollars will flow to the towns in theory, more freely. What do you think of his reverse pilot program?
Well, I think it's a really interesting idea. So Quinnipiac University, if they were a taxable entity, would pay the town something like $8.5 million in property taxes.
Not that you're counting.
No, not that I'm counting. We get a pilot of a little over two.
Yep.
All right. So that's for our residents, that's a mil and a half of just lost revenue. However, right now, in Connecticut, the drivers of the economy are these institutions and the hospitals. So we have to make sure that we're not speaking out of both sides of our mouths when we say, well, let's just whack the big institutions, because those institutions are the ones who are our major employers and our major opportunities to incubate new business. And Brendan understands this, which is why, sort of as he was working through the process, he had sort of both a carrot and a stick. And the carrot was, go and work out your own independent deal, your own MOU, and we won't worry about the taxes, to really kind of encourage the institutions and the municipalities to work together for sort of the common good.
So the thing that I put to him when he raised that issue, which I think makes a whole lot of sense, but to me, on its face, what that does is it actually gets away from the idea of regionalization that both you and he talk about, which essentially means you and every other town has to go and negotiate your own deals with your own nonprofits. And so then that whole regional issue that we're talking about actually isn't regional at all. It's Hamden sort of versus Quinnipiac over a certain amount of money. It's Yale versus New Haven, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering if that is, from a regional standpoint, the very best way to go about things, to, you know, keep it in these little fiefdoms, these little communities.
Well, and, you know, it's a really keen observation. So at first, Brendan, he didn't really understand why some statewide organizations would say, well, we don't want to go in that direction. And I said it this way. So Quinnipiac is buying up property in North Haven as well. My good friend Mike Frieda in North Haven, under this scenario, would have an opportunity to cut a deal with Quinnipiac and be done with it. And I have the opportunity to cut a deal with Quinnipiac and be done with it. But what happens if his deal is better than my deal?
That's a great question.
I look ineffective. And sometimes people are really concerned about looking ineffective. Which is one of the reasons why some of these things that seem at 10,000 feet to make perfect sense, when you get down into the weeds of it, can be really challenging to implement.
Well, there's this idea of being ineffective, but let's say, you know, he cuts one sort of deal, you cut another sort of deal. Now all of a sudden Quinnipiac says, you know, it's a much better deal to just put more jobs and more, let's really do building, let's build in North Haven, let's not build in Hamden. And then all of a sudden it becomes a campus that's a Hamden campus into a North Haven campus. And then you end up with some of the same struggles that all communities in our state seem to face over getting, I don't know, everything from a big box store to a big employer. You know, people are constantly building a big box store development right on the border so that they can grab the taxes, but the other guy's got to deal with all the traffic. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. And at the same time, way too often here in Connecticut, we pat ourselves on the back when we steal a company from a town two towns over. And now they're with us.
Sometimes the state even incentivizes that.
It's true. But then, you know, we call that economic development when not one person is going to move and invest that town because the distance doesn't make any sense. It's not economic development. It's just sort of a reshuffling. To the extent that the underlying property tax, which can include local incentives as well as state incentives, but from the property tax standpoint, if folks are looking at that very little bottom line, it's just not economic development, and it's not moving us forward.
But I'm wondering if you can comment on that, because it's another thing that we've covered a bit on this program is this idea of the state reaching out with economic development packages that will do things like incentivize a company to move from one town to another. Not only is that, as you say, not economic development writ large, it's also, it can be very damaging to one town. It really can work against this idea of better regional government. I mean, do you think that the state, with its limited resources, is spending too much money giving tax breaks to corporations because they say, hey, we might move, so cut us a better deal. Give us a first five or $100 million to stay put.
Well, In my quaint little hamlet, we don't really have the space or the infrastructure for those types of deals. So I can't say that I'm versed enough, in the Stanford style deals that have certainly captured a lot of ink. But what I can say is that we have our 15 towns have a regional economic development organization known as Rex Development. It's a federal economic development district, and we, with great leadership out of Mayor Harp and Matt Nemerson in New Haven, as well as some other folks, are really trying to break out of this this competition between towns. Because what we want is we want to attract new business, and we want to keep a lot of the people who are coming out of our institutions going up to Cambridge or going out down south or west. We want to keep them here, allow them to incubate here, and grow their jobs here. And that doesn't take incentives. It takes a regional group of colleagues. It needs other types of sort of physical infrastructure, getting from New Haven to New York, getting from New Haven to Boston. These are very important things.
Transportation investment, absolutely.
Absolutely. So that is where we see some of our challenges. I mean, when you have one bridge in Norwalk that prevents people in Hamden and New Haven from getting to their jobs in New York 116 times, that's a big problem, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed.
We're talking with Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden. Before we take a break, I want to talk just a little bit more about your town's relationship with Quinnipiac University. Obviously, Quinnipiac has gone from being a fairly moderately sized college not so many years ago to a sprawling big university. It's got campuses in various parts of your town, in North Haven as well. It has national recognition because of its polling institute and because of some of its sports teams, all things that 10 years ago didn't really exist in the way that we know them now. You've been critical in some ways of the way Quinnipiac has expanded and critical of the way students who are part of the Quinnipiac community have integrated, for lack of a better word, with the Hamden locals. Give me your sense right now of what the relationship is between Hamden, your town, and Quinnipiac, this big university that's right there in the middle of your town.
Well, the media certainly likes to focus in on conflict when it can, and that includes the Quinnipiac Chronicle, the on-campus paper. So Quinnipiac, on July 10th, 1989, a tornado went down my street, and I got to live for a week at the old Quinnipiac, much smaller, much older. John Leahy, the president of Quinnipiac, has done the type of job in building that institution over a 25-year period that is unmatched. There is no model for what he's done. He is the model for university expansion. And that helps Hamden. And I'll tell you some ways in which it helps Hamden. You know, every town in the state of Connecticut has to go to Wall Street for their ratings, interviews, and you know, the 24-year-old analyst on the other side just kind of flips through. But Quinnipiac jumps out at them. They know Quinnipiac. Quinnipiac has a very close connection with Wall Street. So Quinnipiac helps us because it helps us rise a little bit above the fray in terms of our ratings, and it's an institution of value. We have seen a tremendous increase in their student population. They have grown their population by leaps and bounds. And we were having a lot of trouble because they weren't building dorms at a commensurate rate. We were having a lot of problems because these students had greater buying power than Hamden families. So from an investment standpoint, you can make money by buying a cape, running it out to four students and charging them $1,000 a piece. A cape in Hamden, Connecticut, you would never get a $4,000 mortgage, but you get $4,000 worth of monthly income. So it made sense, and we lost a lot of properties to investors, which really had a negative effect on neighborhoods. If you have to get your kids up on a Friday morning to get them to daycare at 8:30, a party next door that goes till 2 on Thursday night is not your friend. So what the town allowed them to do was literally blow the top off a mountain and build new dorms. And they've done that. They haven't built all of the beds that they're permitted for, but they showed good faith in building. And they're going to get back into construction, I think, next year on some additional beds. But we still have a lot of students living in the neighborhoods. And that's something that just the students have to understand how to be good neighbors. And that's the message that we try to convey. And that is something that the university leadership has sort of committed to as we start the new year in making another strong push to say you're living in a town. This is not your personal playground.
Quickly, before we take a break, is there, in your mind, a long-term plan for or how you would hope this plays out? Because Hamden has grown, as you say, substantially since you grew up there, but not as quickly by a long shot as Quinnipiac has grown in just the last couple decades. Is it growing too fast? Is there something that has to be done? Do you have a long-term plan for what you think this community with this university inside it will look like beyond the short term that we're talking about, you know, making students better neighbors, absolutely. But what do you think the long-term plan is for this university being part of the Hamden community?
Well, one of the places that we the physical spaces that we share is a stretch of Whitney Avenue, Route 10 in Hamden between the Mount Carmel Connector and the university campuses. The economic development there is a little bit behind the curve. We're hoping to partner with Quinnipiac to improve that in a way that, but not in a way that just benefits students and their buying power, but benefits everyone. We are hopefully going to start a program where they want to pledge some more transparency in terms of their long-term development goals and get the impact not only of the town government but of the general citizens in vetting those plans. So that's something that we're hoping to kick off next year. And I think understanding where they want to go is going to be the key piece for us in terms of saying, well, okay, that one makes sense. Let's connect it with another project that we're looking at here and start to integrate our actions that way a little bit better.
A quick phone call from Mick, who's calling from Hamden. Hi, Mick.
Hello. Hi, Scott. It's Mick McGarry.
Hello, Councilman.
I wanted to talk about the Quinnipiac problem because, as you know, my district includes the university. And one of the issues that we have is that entire roads are becoming de facto dormitories. A new road is no longer a neighborhood. It's now a dorm, essentially. And right across the street from my house, some person from out of town has purchased the house and is going to turn it over and rent to Quinnipiac students. So, you know, instead of having the nice old ladies who gave my kids Halloween candy, it's now a question mark. I could have wonderful students, as there are many wonderful students who live in neighborhoods, or I could have some rowdy students, and that is a difficulty. And is there anything we can do to slow down the spread of these third-party landlords? Quinnipiac buying a house is one thing, but somebody from Cheshire or Orange buying a house, they don't care about a neighborhood. They just care about a profit. And what can we do about that?
Mick, thank you very much for your phone call.
Well, the market is the market. And so can you prevent someone from buying a house? No. No, you can't. You start to run into all sorts of fair housing issues if you try to go that road. But so where I went to college, there was an area called College Town. And normal families hadn't lived there in 100 years.
This is Cornell, right?
That's Cornell, yeah. And so it had its own way of working because there weren't families around. So there is a singular road that the Quinnipiac has or that the university has determined it wants to essentially buy this road. It's a little bit off the beaten path. And that makes a lot more sense to me because it's university sort of controlled and visioned. But what Councilman McGarry is talking about is just sort of the speculative investment. And one of the things that we need to do continually with the university is make sure that the market for that speculative investment is depressed by building more dorms and making sure that all the beds on the dorms are filled. Then the investors look at it and say, well, I might not make my margins because that's their driving role. So the specific answer to the councilman's question is working with the university to make sure that as many beds are constructed and filled through every mechanism that they have to do that in order to move kids back onto campus. Now, the flip side of that is that no resident, well, Quinnipiac family or Quinnipiac students moving next to you, you should introduce yourself. And the Quinnipiac students should give you all their cell phone numbers and say, if you got a problem, call me before you call the police. You call them. If there's still a problem, you call the police, and we are going to start snatching back student housing permits. But there needs to be a document record for that. So you know, what I would advise the folks in town to do is be nice. Be nice once. and if you don't get the response that you need, call the authorities.
We're going to take a break. Scott Jackson is the mayor of Hamden. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, which he heads up for Governor Malloy. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking with Scott Jackson. He's the mayor of Hamden, Connecticut. We've been talking about big ideas in regionalization, town-gown relations, and some of the other things that he faces as the head of a very interesting town, and what we call an inner-ring suburb just outside of New Haven. It's one of the larger towns by landmass in the state. There's a lot to talk about Hamden. That's what we've been spending our time on, but we just have a few minutes left, and I want to talk to you about your role in the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission. You continue to meet, and you continue to take testimony. Just this last week, you took testimony from some parents of those killed. What is it you're hearing right now that you are learning still as you take testimony about the shooting in Sandy Hook?
We learn new things every day. And sometimes we remember things we've forgotten. The testimony from the parents last Friday was, it was wrenching. It was wrenching. But they talked about very different things. But one of the things that we want to take a look at is the effectiveness of the recovery efforts. Now, recovery is it's a long process. It's decades. We're not going to get to the end of it. But we want to know sort of where the parents were falling in terms of what they saw as strengths and weaknesses. And one of the weaknesses was capacity. And so I think that goes right to the regionalism that we talked about before. I don't think there is a town in Connecticut. I don't think Bridgeport, Connecticut could have managed a tragedy of that international scope. So one of the things that we need to do, because unfortunately we keep reading about these things, we keep seeing them on TV, we have to get together in advance and come up with our tiered responses and make sure that we exercise them so that, God forbid, something terrible should happen. We're able to respond in a more cohesive way.
This means communication. It means working across town lines. Is it something that you feel like when your work is done with this commission, you will have some recommendations in place that the state can act on?
Absolutely. We did an interim report shortly after we started meeting with a number of suggestions, mostly in terms of maturity. The most mature ones were in safe school design and operation, which many have been crafted into law. But taking a look at some of the larger issues, particularly law enforcement response, I mentioned the Blue Plan earlier in the show from the Capital Region Council of Governments. That was a presentation that we had that when I brought back to my chief of police in Hamden, he said that makes 100% absolute sense. So these are the things that we have to work on, and we have to use our authority as the commission. I mean, we're an advisory commission. We have no investigative powers. We don't have subpoena authority. We don't have any of that. We're kind of supposed to be the dry policy folks. But we do have the sort of the moral authority to say these are the things that make sense and try to move the state in the right direction.
We just have 30 seconds left. Serving on this commission, did it change your view of community at all?
Yes. Yes, it did. We all felt on that day, we felt like we lived in Newtown. So every day we build these walls around ourselves, but on that day, when the chips were down, we felt like we were all one. And that's the America that I love.
Scott Jackson is the mayor of Hamden, Connecticut. Thank you very much for spending the hour with us. I really appreciate the conversation.
Happy to be here.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer of our show is Katie Tolarski. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter @WhereWeLive. I'm John Dankosky.